My name is Michael Coates, and I'm the co-founder of two veteran-owned organisations. And these conversations are dedicated to supporting the crosshair where business meets the military. This episode is the one we talk about influence and assets. And we are pleased to welcome the man who has wrote the book on it. Daniel Priestley is a four-time best-selling author, successful entrepreneur, and international speaker. We also talk about role models, mental resilience, and the UN global goals. This is part of the Declassified Network, and this is the Forces Friendly podcast. Born in 1981, was business always part of your life growing up?
Not in a huge way. It wasn't not part of my life. My dad was a school teacher. My mum was a journalist when I was growing up, but dad also had little side hustles. So he would have he had this little surfing newspaper that he ran and had a couple of advertisers, and he did a bit of what was called desktop publishing back in the day, which is basically he bought himself an Apple Mac and would design people's flyers and brochures and things like that. So I do remember having a dad who was entrepreneurial, a mum who was a writer, but I mean, essentially both of them had normal jobs. And I really didn't kind of have a word for entrepreneurship or a thought around entrepreneurship until I was a teenager.
What did mum write?
She was a journalist for the local newspaper.
Okay. Did she specialise in anything?
Features. Feature stories, interviewing people, different people who would come to town.
And what did your dad teach?
He was primary school teacher. He did physical education. He had a class, very small rural school. I think it was four teachers and maybe 100 kids.
Where was that?
There's a place called Geelong, south of Melbourne.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Good Aussie rules too.
Yeah, Cats.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And then from there, was there any kind of military experience, or was you exposed to the military in Australia?
Very limited way. So my dad's cousin was a naval officer who would come and visit, and he would bring me the little badges. He actually worked in submarines. And I knew that I had military background in the family. So my grandfather was a Palestinian police officer at the end of World War II. He was very briefly in World War II. He enrolled towards, you know, months before the end of the war. And then he was 6 years in Palestine doing riot police, military policing kind of thing. And then his father was in India as an officer. So it's kind of in the family. As with most people, you know, grandparents and great uncles and aunts in various capacities in World War One and Two.
Was you kind of switched on as a kid? Was you clever growing up and in school?
I don't really know if I was or I wasn't. I was in a very small rural school, so I don't think I had a lot to compare to. We were just very much a small school, and I don't know whether I was smart or not, to be honest.
Yeah. You ended up in Army Cadets, so a bit of that.
I was in Army Cadets as a teenager, which I loved. I was a scout. I was a cub, then a scout, then an Army Cadet.
Yeah.
So I loved running around out and about with paint on my face and doing all of the drills. And we used to kind of get around in the personnel carriers and go down on the rifle range and fire some rounds off of a F-88 Steyr and all that kind of stuff.
Do you think it's good for kids? I'm not going to go too much into parenting, but to be able to have structure and kind of extracurricular and getting out.
Honestly, I know it could take us off on a tangent, but I think young men in particular need structure. They need hierarchies and those sorts of things. I think actually there's a huge issue in communities at the moment that from 15 to 25, you're full of testosterone. You want to prove yourself in some way. You want to add value in some way. You want to demonstrate that you're a valuable member of the tribe, so to speak. And there's very few places left to be able to do that. You know, in times gone past, you had the military to enroll into. You had mines, fishing, all of these kind of very brave places that you could go, and now a lot of young men don't have that, and they end up acting out in stupid ways, I think.
We'll get onto role models in a second, but I'm glad you touched on it there, because that was, for me, that them formative years were vital to have that structure and release of the testosterone. You mentioned there about teenager being an advocate, but also the introduction to business.
I thrived on hierarchy, believe it or not. I mean, now I'm an entrepreneur, I can't stand the idea of having a boss. But I loved it. I mean, I really love chain of command and just that clarity around who's in charge and, you know, that kind of the you know, just the drills and the activities and all of that. So I absolutely loved it at the time.
If you look at the structure in a business, then you've got, and we'll get to this later on as well, but then you've got systems, mm-hmm. like putting systems mm-hmm. in place. Each action has a consequence and how you follow that through.
Yeah.
Business then, when was your first kind of touch point?
So at a very early age, I had a brush with entrepreneurship when Mum accidentally set fire to the kitchen, and it got put out really fast, but a lot of stuff got smoke damaged. And I had it in my head that I would clean it and sell it. And it was cutlery and some electronics and all that sort of stuff. So I thought it wasn't damaged, that it didn't work. I was going to clean it up. I was going to sell it. I was going to run a garage sale. And on the night before the garage sale, I didn't have enough stuff. So I got it in my head. I was only 10 or 11 at the time. I got it in my head that I was going to go to all the neighbours and do a 50-50 joint venture where I'd keep a note in my notepad as to what they'd given me, and then I'd sell it and then we'd split it 50-50. Remarkably, all the neighbours bought into this idea, and in the afternoon I went round to the neighbours. They all gave me a wheelbarrow full of stuff and I sold it on a 50-50 split. And at 10 or 11, I made $300. My cut was $300. And this was enough for a BMX bike, a Sega Master System, and a game. And this was like, I was proper, like I was blinging.
Yeah.
I was very, very happy with myself at that age.
Did you carry it on?
That was my first entrepreneurial experience. I did run two more garage sales throughout my high school years. I ran a nightclub party for our school, which raised a lot of money for the school, a couple of grand for the school. And so that was in the basketball stadium. We turned it into a nightclub and hired a DJ and all this sort of stuff. And then when I got out, because I'd done that in year 11, year 12, I got out and did my first year at university, and I found myself living in a garage with rug on the floor, mattress on the floor, five of us living in a three-bedroom place, and I was Pizza Hut delivery driving for $3.25 per delivery, including all the running of my car. I was working in bars on Friday and Saturday night. I mean, I was just working all the time, and I was falling behind on my university studies, and I thought, why don't I run a nightclub party? So I ended up contacting one of the top nightclubs that we used to go to because I'd turned 18. And I said, I want to run an underage nightclub party on a Tuesday night when you normally closed during the school holidays. Anyway, it was actually quite a big success, and went on to run six parties over the course of a year or two. And each one, I think the first one made a few grand, and then we built it up, made it more successful, partnered with the local radio station, and ended up making 12 grand in a night on the last one, which was pretty – the final party was amazing because it was 1,000 kids at $12 a head. All costs were covered. Every cost had been sponsored, and the local radio station had given us $7,000 worth of radio advertising as their naming rights sponsorship. And that meant that we had absolutely no costs in filling it or running it, and it was $12,000 in cash straight to the pocket.
Mm.
So that was great.
But it spread over a year. And trial and error.
Yeah. It was about, well, no, the first party was 400 kids times $6, I think. So it was a couple of grand, and most things were covered. And then we got better at it. So I ran, it was six parties over 18 months, I would have said.
Mm.
It was just great. It was really good fun.
And you was out of uni at this point, or was you still in?
I was in uni. I did 1 year of uni before dropping out. What happened is in the first year of uni, I ran the first nightclub party, and all of my lecturers at university kept saying, wow, you've run a business, a real business, and they were asking me lots of questions. And I immediately cottoned on to the fact that none of them had actually run a business. They'd all come through the academic chain, and that none of them had sold anything or been out in the field doing actual business. Some of them had been consultants, but none of them had actually personally employed people or launched products or any of that sort of stuff. They were business lecturers.
Mm.
That was their job. I was really disappointed by this. I don't know where I had it in my head, but I thought that when you went to uni, you'd get like millionaires teaching you how to do business and people who'd really, you know, they'd been super successful and now they're giving back by teaching in university. In my head, because I thought, well, you know, you're going to go and learn medicine from a doctor who's done operations and all this sort of stuff. So, you know, if a proper surgeon would teach you surgery, then a proper business person would teach you business. In my head, that's made sense. So I was very disappointed to discover that none of them had actually run a business. So I dropped out. I dropped out to go and work for a guy who was starting a real business and to basically be his employee number three. Mm.
Go on. So what was that then? What was that involved?
So I was about 19, 20 years old, and I heard about this guy who had previously been a successful entrepreneur. He was late 30s, so he's 38 years old, which I'm 38 now. So at the time, he seemed really old, but now I know he was really young. And so John was basically launching a marketing business, an event marketing business, and he was going to do some promotions up and down Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne. And I went to his house. He had a beautiful big house in Noosa in the waterfront home, and he had three kids under five. I now have three kids under five, so I know how stressed he was. But he was launching this business, and he basically had himself and his wife. He had Sophia and Amy, who were the accounts girls and event management. And then he had myself and then Julia, who were the two salespeople. So I was in sales, Julia was in sales, and we basically, I got thrown straight onto the phones to book appointments and make sales appointments and book appointments for him and for Julia. But I also did a lot more than that. So I basically did everything from handling marketing campaigns to hiring some people to coming up with ideas for direct mail campaigns, looking at spreadsheets and budgets, tracking down venues, tracking down marketing, newspaper advertising space, all of this kind of stuff. I just threw myself into this job and I worked all hours. So I would start as early as I could and I'd go right through into the evening and I'd do weekends if necessary. Like I'd just do whatever I could because I wanted to learn everything. I did this for 2 years and the company grew very, very rapidly. So we ended up with three or four of us on day one. And then we were 60 people 2 years later. We went from a zero standing start to about $6-7 million in revenue in 2 years. So that was down to John. John had done it before. He knew what he was doing. He was an experienced marketer and an experienced entrepreneur. So I just got myself under his wing, and everything I'd hoped to be learning in university, mm-hmm. I started learning from John. He gave me really weird mentoring as well. Like he took it on himself to properly mentor me, and he would always give me these ridiculous challenges. So I had to carry around $2,000 cash at all times, which was one of his challenges. I had to completely stop reading any news or watching any news or listening to any news. So so he completely banned news and news radio and everything. I had to take two strangers out for lunch each week. So I had to always, every single week, I had to meet someone completely new and take them out for lunch. Mm. So that was...
And what did that do for you then, those three things? 2K so the, news, so the, meeting new people.
The $2,000 cash, he recognised that I thought that $2,000 was a lot of money. Like in my mind, $2,000 was, you know, I mean, I'd been on $3.25 per delivery at Pizza Hut. So he recognised that in my head, I still had residue, despite the nightclub parties. But he really, in my head, he said, you need to start thinking of $2,000 as pocket change. And because we were selling products that were about $2,000 to $5,000 when we were on the phones and all that. And he said, I can't have you talking to people about $2,000 spend as though it's the biggest money in the world. I need you to think about $2,000 as though that's just the amount of money you keep in your pocket. Hmm. So he said, you need to keep $2,000 in your pocket as pocket change until such time as you're not really worried or concerned about $2,000. So sure enough, I kept it in a bulldog clip and I always had $2,000 on me. He, with the news, he said, as an entrepreneur, you can worry about the things that you have an impact on. He says, right now, as a 19-year-old, you don't have any impact on politics or world events or, you know, what's going on in New York or what's going on in Canberra. I want you just focused on what you have the power to change and what you have, I don't want you to spend your stress and spend your mental energy on problems that you are not in a position to solve. I want you to spend your mental energy on stuff that you can solve. So if you've got time for the news, why don't you write an ad, or why don't you write a sales script, or why don't you read a book about how you can improve in your role, but do something that relates to your life, not the lives of people on the other side of the world. Otherwise, you're just going to stress about something you've got no control over at 19. So that was his thing. He said, you're going to put all your energy into a focused place.
Mm.
And what was the other one that I told? Oh, taking strangers out to lunch.
Mm.
Well, he's just simply said, in business is about reaching out to people you don't know yet. You've got to get good at reaching out to people, meeting new people, building rapport with people, doing joint ventures, spotting opportunities, spotting connections. So I just want you to get good at going out and talking to people who are a bit above your station. So mm-hmm. he suggested that I take out for lunch people who were accountants or lawyers, people who were, marketing executives. He said, I want you to take out people, he said, because you've got to pay for their lunch. So twice a week you got to take people out, and you're offering to pay for lunch. So I want you to go and take people out to lunch who you're going to learn something from them, that it's worth buying them lunch to learn something. So
was you going there with a sales head on, or was you going?
No,
there
this
just
was
to...
outside of my sales role.
Yeah.
So this okay. was just this was I was not there to sell, and he was very clear about that.
Personal
this is,
development.
This is just you going and sitting down and learning from someone who's a little older and a little wiser. Twice a week.
Ah, was it a good way then, especially the third thing? Was it a good way of meeting people? Did people feel like they had self-worth almost?
They always felt it. Most people, I think, felt it was a bit strange, this 19-year-old inviting them out to lunch. It's like, hey, you're an accountant. Can I take you out for lunch? I'm 19 and looking to learn, and I'll buy lunch. I'll take you out to a nice place that has a view of the ocean, and we'll grab a lunch. And they're like, oh, okay. And I've just literally reach out. They'd never heard of me before, and I'd reach out and say, I saw you advertised in the newspaper that you're an accountant. Can I take you out for lunch?
It's a bit bonkers when you think about it.
But
actually, that repetition, that habit of doing that, you get so much more comfortable with speaking with people you don't know, asking the right question,
totally.
Taking information.
And just having a sit-down lunch with someone you don't know.
Mm.
Exactly.
We can all too often just fall into this kind of comfort zone of being around your own friends and your family, and instead of reaching out.
And you've got to reach out. If you're going to be in business, you've got to be talking to people. You've got to be suggesting partnerships and spotting someone who could help, and just reach out and talk to them. You got to access resources beyond your control.
This is a funny one. So since really I've known you, going out and speaking to people, especially where, you know, you think of it as a different class or a different earnings of money or whatever it is, like people who in normal life you wouldn't normally associate with, but just getting really, really comfortable with speaking with anybody. And again, asking questions, feeling comfortable in their presence, knowing who you are, what you're, even down to what you're wearing, the shoes you're wearing, just going into these places and being comfortable is really, really, really important. What did you do then? So going from being with John, real mentorship and guidance from him, how did you then make the transition out of that business?
So in year two, I'd done some really successful marketing campaigns, and I had my own P&L, and I'd made over $600,000 worth of sales through my marketing and over 175 grand worth of profit. And I went to John prior to Christmas, I think it was, and said, hey, look, you know, here's my P&L, 600 grand revenue, 175 profit that I've directly generated for this business. And I said, look, I'd really love to talk to you about some sort of a bonus or, you know, something because I've taken initiative and I've been here from the start. I was just a cheeky 20-year-old, something like this. So I thought 2 years was a very long time to have been doing something. And John said, look, you know, I've been teaching you, you've been learning a lot, but you're not going to get like some big bonus for this. You've been doing your job. And I said, oh, look, you know, what about if I could get just a small amount of shares in the company? And I'd caught him at the wrong time, and he said to me, listen, Dan, if you want shares in a company, you go start your own company. And then my bonus was, I think, $250. So we took that out and drunk it. and with some friends. And then in my hungover state, I went, you know what, I am going to go and start my own business, and I'm just going to go and do what I know how to make 600 grand in sales and 175 in profit. In fact, I know how to do that double as well. So I went and launched my own company the following year. So I was 21, 22 at that point, and I set up my own company, and I literally kind of copied the formula that I'd learned from John. And we did 1.3 million in the first year and 400,000 profit. And that was my year one of business. So it was pretty yeah, it was pretty good first go at it.
Mm. So did you have a good relationship with John after that then? Or was it soured?
I do today, and I think I did about a year or two after, but I think after I'd launched, we didn't really talk much for a year or two, and then we reconnected and caught up, and we were all good after that.
Mm. Where did it go after year one then? So phenomenal year one.
Phenomenal year one, and then we hit a few challenges at the end of year one, and I had to rethink the business. We had a flat year two, and then we were reinventing the business, and then we took off, and we went and did a joint venture deal with another company, and together we made just under $11 million worth of sales, and it was split between the two companies. And basically I made a lot of money in that, or a lot of money for a 24-year-old in that year.
How was a joint venture run like that then? What was you doing?
It was a bit complex. We could spend almost the whole podcast talking about that deal, but basically they were a franchise organization who had sold about $1 million a year worth of franchises for the last 3 years. I'd seen them at a franchise show. I knew I had the marketing strategy to grow them rapidly. So I went to the CEO and I said, look, you're going to make $1 million, maybe $2 million worth of sales next year. What about on the first $2 million worth of sales, we get 15% commission, next to nothing, but we'll take over all the expenses and the costs and the running of it. But over $2 million, I want 70% of the franchise fees, because it's basically all cream for you after that. And I think that was roughly speaking, that was the deal. And because I was massively incentivized to cross the 2 million, I went all in. I took a huge risk. I took out a lot of marketing. We really pushed hard to promote this thing. And then we just took off, and we got the marketing right. We got the marketing approach right. And we started selling $1 million a month worth of franchises. So once I'd cracked over that first 2 million of sales, it was very much stacked my way after that. And we didn't have much overhead on looking after the franchisees, because that was their job and they made their money on the long tail of the franchisees. And they had 30% for the initial training costs of the franchisees, but we took the lion's share of the upfront.
Balls. Just, you know, like there's a lot of experience being really ballsy there. You keep saying we. Was it just you as a business partner, or was the others involved?
No, at that point I didn't have business partners. I had one guy who was a friend who was earning into the business. He had taken a massive reduction in income, in wage, in order to earn in on some shares, a small portion of shares. But when I say we, look, I always use the term we simply because I've always had a team. So in the same way that John recruited a team of four people on day one of the business, I also recruited a team of four people on day one of my business, and very rapidly built that to a 7 or 8 person team. I've personally never, ever been a solopreneur in the sense that I've never worked alone and been a solo person. I've always kicked off businesses. I've kicked off, I think, 7 or 8 businesses now. I've always kicked off businesses with a team of 3 or 4 people to begin with. And the other thing too is I lean on the team to get things done. So it feels incredibly wrong to say me or I, just simply because I might own a company. It doesn't mean that I got the result. We got the result as a team working together. So I look, it's just something that doesn't feel right to say I.
Mm. We're going to structure a little bit later on, but who were the first 3 or 4 people then who you are employing? Is there a formula
always
that you use?
Always a salesperson.
Yeah.
Someone who's constantly picking up the phone, setting appointments, doing sales, bringing in money. So always a salesperson. Always what I call a Swiss Army knife. Swiss Army knife is someone who can do 25 things badly. you know, just sort of a young, you know, in that, in my first business, it was a guy called Nick, and Nick could basically, you know, if it was photocopying, if it was typing something, if it was data entry, if it was picking up the phone, making some phone calls, if it was booking a venue, if it was booking flights or physically moving something into a storage shed, Nick was just a 25 functions Swiss Army knife. Normally a graphic designer, someone who can design brochures, collateral, someone who can put together a little, in today's language, a little website. Because so much of business is communicating through visuals, that sort of thing.
That's it. So not freelance, that would be employed in-house, would it? Or would you how would you do it?
Yeah, like a fairly decent contract in terms of them being fairly...
Around, yeah.
But also everyone's got secondaries. So, you know, in a startup there's always work to be done. So you've got your primaries and your secondaries. So your primary might be that you do the design and the operations, or you're working on creating stuff, and then your secondary might be running an event or supporting a sales process, or you know, something like that, or picking up the phone and booking some things that need doing. So we're not precious about everyone having their own little siloed off role, but it's kind of like I want a few skills around me. I want some sales skills, I want some design skills, I want some, you know, just hard work, roll up the sleeves, practical kind of skills.
Yeah. When did you come to the UK?
So, at the end of that partnership that was $11 million, I was burnt out and very much sick of that partner. They were sick of us. They felt that they were paying too much now that they could see how it was done. So we had a bit of a falling out right before Christmas. They invited us over to Perth. It was an 8-hour flight right before Christmas. And then we arrived at 6 a.m. and they left us sitting in the foyer of the offices until 4 p.m. while they had a board meeting. And myself and Glenn, who went on that flight, were absolutely fuming. And then they basically wanted to have a very brief little meeting about what we could do next year. And on the spot, Glenn and I had already decided between 6 a.m. and 4 p.m. that we were done with them and that we were going to resign. So we just basically said, the partnership's off, we're going to go do our own thing. Didn't have a plan, but we just knew we didn't want to work with them anymore. We were cocky enough and arrogant enough and had enough money in the bank to sort of just say, you know what, we'll figure it out. And then I hadn't travelled, so I wanted to travel. And then a friend of mine, a mentor, Paul, said to me, why don't you go to the UK? And I know this guy who wants to launch his products into the UK, and it's a really great thing. And why don't you go and do a deal and launch this guy, Roger, into the UK? So I basically took that contract and came over to the UK and launched this guy called Roger, who was a speaker who had psychometric leadership profiling tools, and he had training workshops and all that sort of stuff, and we just came in and launched them here.
He is a force of nature.
Yeah, you know Roger?
Yeah. I met him in Singapore last
year. So we launched Roger here in London.
Yeah. So you marketed him?
We took an exclusive arrangement to market him and all of his products and everything in the UK on a deal, on a license deal.
And that was that Paul Dunn then?
Paul Dunn.
Yeah, who linked you together.
Who put us in touch, yeah. Small world.
Good network.
Yeah.
Then, so you did your business with Roger.
Yeah, then launched Roger, and then that was working. So we took a contract for a guy called John DeMartini, and then we did a deal with another personal development speaker called Bob Proctor, and we basically just started promoting speakers in London and having we had some of the dragons from Dragon's Den. So we were just having a great time promoting events and making tons of money and having great fun, and we had this really funky office in Fulham, and everything was going really well. And then the entire world fell apart in 2008 with the financial markets, and no one wanted to buy training or leadership or personal development or any of that sort of stuff. The idea of someone spending £1,000 on a personal development retreat, people were like, no, I'm just going to spend £1,000 on groceries, thank you very much. So, you know, there was a couple of years there where it was actually – it was harder to make a sale of a couple of hundred pounds than it had previously been to make a sale of a few thousand pounds. And we had to we had a team of, I think, 16 or 17, and it ended up being three or four. And this was around the time 2008, 2009, where I'm thinking, wow, what do I really want to do with my life? And I just went searching for what business to start next, or what to do next, or what I wanted to be up to. And I'd taken a big blood nose, basically. I'd lost hundreds of thousands of pounds in a year just trying to hold on to the business and not firing people. The thing about a recession is that you know that people can't get jobs easily, so you don't want to fire people. So I held on to staff and I held on to payroll, even though we were hemorrhaging 100 grand a month type thing. I also stupidly, I'd never been through a recession before, so I also had this weird idea of like, you know what, if I just keep marketing, everyone else will stop marketing and I'll keep marketing and we'll make all the money and they'll all run scared, but we'll be brave and we'll just run head in. And that lasted 3 or 4 months before I realized that wasn't a good idea.
Was it pride then? Or was it a bit of like looking after your team?
Looking after the team. Yeah, it was like, I just don't want to fire people and know that they can't get jobs. And also, it was probably a bit of pride. I don't want to have a smaller business. I want to get the business bigger every year. In 2007, we'd run a 2,000-person event at the London Palladium Theatre. We'd made hundreds of thousands of pounds in a day. We were on fire and we were doing so well, and couldn't believe that something completely outside of my control, the economy, could actually change my business. Or, you know, it's like, well, why on earth, you know, that's the financial markets, that's Lehman Brothers, like what on earth has that got to do with me? I didn't realize that the front page of the newspaper saying we are in a recession, we are going to be in a 10-year recession. I didn't have the experience to know that actually meant that I had to change the way I ran my business.
Bloody John telling you not to look at newspapers.
Yeah, I blame John. He got his last
John.
Laugh on me.
I blame
me.
John as well.
Yeah, last laugh right there.
The so the resilience side of things, actually just coping with stress. Was it a stressful period
Very
of your life?
Very stressful. I'll tell you one of them. The stressful parts of it are I'd been living in a beautiful penthouse apartment, like a really swanky GQ style penthouse apartment. And I ended up having to move into my sister's spare room. And my sister's 7.5 years younger than I am. So she had her starter flat. And I just didn't have the money or the bandwidth or the resources in my head to go and find another flat and to set up another flat. So I just made this decision that I couldn't continue or I wasn't going to renew the lease with this place. So I was going to go somewhere and I didn't know where to go. So I ended up staying. So I literally went from this huge penthouse to this tiny little room. I had a girlfriend, and that put a lot of stress on the relationship, of course. And then it was just juggling so many things. And also the culture of our company was like all very young and energized people who used to party together and go, you know, go out on weekends together and go sit in the park together and all this sort of stuff. And we're all more like friends than work colleagues. And now I'm having to fire them. You know, it's just terrible.
Did you get low at that point?
Yeah, I did actually. I really did. I think there was a point there where something happened, I don't even know what, but I do remember I banged my hand into the wall hard enough to have to go to A&E. So I didn't quite punch the wall, but I banged the wall thinking it was like a plaster wall and it was actually a concrete wall. And so I must have been, like, for me to be doing something as stupid as that and actually banging it hard enough to have to go and get an X-ray.
Yeah.
I must have been at breaking point.
Yeah, yeah. And with regards to kind of like failure as well, do you accept failure? Because it sounded like some of the business was kind of crumbling a bit outside of your control, really.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, failure is an interesting one because you fail all the time in business. If you go and do 10 sales meetings, you make 2 sales. So you fail 8 times out of 10.
Yeah.
You know, that's just how it is. If you run an ad to 100,000 people, you might get 12 people respond. You know, so you fail 99,900 times. So failure is a huge part of business. You just have to get your head around the fact that the bigger your business, the more doesn't work. But there's a different kind of failure, which is kind of systemically you're watching the business falling apart and you're kind of doing everything you know how to do. Up until that point, I'd only ever experienced a buoyant economy.
Mm.
I'd only ever had the wind in my sails.
Where was the next move then?
So we got down to three people. So I remember one Christmas party and it was a massive party with all the people. And I actually remember the following year's Christmas party was three of us around a table.
Mm.
And that was not a party. That was had the vibe of a funeral.
Mm.
I just started, you know, I had a little bit of money left and I started thinking about, what am I going to do? What do I want to do differently? What have I learned in all of this? And I was excited by these things called accelerator programs in Silicon Valley, Y Combinator. And basically they get a whole bunch of young people, stick them in a room, give them $5,000 and let them start companies. And they were actually producing some really exciting companies. So I was very interested in accelerator programs. And also I had kind of we'd been running training programs and leadership training and all this sort of stuff. So we knew a big part of the element of how an accelerator might look like and how it might work. So I kind of was toying with this idea of an accelerator program. I also, weirdly, John years ago had put me onto the idea that the baby boomers were the big trend, that you had to watch what the baby boomers were doing because they had all the money and you got to create something for baby boomers. So I had this initial idea that what if you created an accelerator program for older people? And rather than having someone who is 22-year-old who can code, why don't you have someone who's 42 who has 15 years experience in their industry and knows about their industry but not necessarily technology? And I thought, oh, okay, there's no one doing anything for that market. You know, this is the majority of business owners are over 40 and yet no one's doing anything that's kind of like a cool, interesting, engaging accelerator program.
Mm.
And then, so that was one line of thinking. And another line of thinking was I'll tell you, this is a big part of the story, actually. There was this guy called John DiMartini, that we were promoting. We had spent a year building his brand and we'd made about £1 million worth of sales for his products, for his trainings and all this sort of stuff. And we'd really built his brand. And then when the economy collapsed, we tried to renegotiate his price and he came into the negotiation and said, I'm going to put my prices up by 5%. And I went, what? He said, well, when there's a recession, there's less people buying. So I want to make more money. I want to make the same money or more. So if there's less people buying, I need to put my prices up, not down. And well, I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm here to see if you'll do a 30% discount. And he's like, no, I'm putting my prices up. And we couldn't do a deal. We just couldn't make those numbers work. Because the other thing that happened, he was paid in US dollars and the US dollar to the pound really changed. And it was just, you know, disastrous. And we were like, well, we just can't make that work. And he went, okay. And he let the contract go and we ended the contract. And then 2 or 3 months later, he started marketing his stuff into the market and doing really well. And the reason he was doing really well is because we'd built his brand.
Mm.
So he had all these fans and all these people. And sure enough, he could afford to undercut the price because now we weren't involved. And he was able to very successfully navigate the recession. And he did really well. I noticed Roger. Roger had lots of demand. And I started to have this thought, rain, hail or shine, good times or bad times, if you're a key person of influence, if you're an author, if you've got a good pitch, if you've got good products, if you're the owner of the products and if you've got a brand and a reputation and followers and fans, if you're that person, it doesn't matter what the economy does to you, the money goes to the person of influence. Because I watched them all do quite well. And it was around that time where another guy said to me, listen, your business isn't worth anything because you're just a broker. All you really do is put people in touch with the real people of value. And you're not one of those people of value. You're just the guy who's good. You're a sales and marketing engine, but you're not the brand. You're not the person that people want to pay to see. And he said, if you really want to make the money, you've got to make yourself that person. And I thought, rather than make myself that person, what if we could make lots of people that person? So we ran this key person of influence accelerator. And basically, those kind of ideas came together. We launched in 2010, and then we just took off again. And basically, the key person of influence accelerator has now run in Australia, Singapore, UK, USA. We're launching in Canada. I've written 4 books. It's been a really great, successful program.
Because you've obviously followed the 5 key points to the 5 P's of your
the 5 P's in the book. Yeah,
yeah, and then. So why did you choose those 5, and what are the 5?
So the 5 are pitching, so the ability to communicate value and get people enrolled and to get people to enroll in the vision or enroll in what you do. I actually had a great interview that I did with Major General Andy Salmon of the Royal Marines, and he said that at his level at Major General, it's all pitching. He said you're constantly out there pitching ideas, getting people enrolled in an idea. Basically, you've got high-ranking people who have conflicting ideas around how something should be done, and you're pitching your idea versus their idea, and you're enrolling people into a way of doing things. So it's interesting. Even in the military, you hit a certain level, you've got to get good at pitching an idea. So that's number one. Second one is publishing content. So publishing books, articles, blogs, podcasts, all of that stuff, just publishing ways for people to learn about you, publishing content. The third one is having products, so making sure you've got a good product ecosystem, you've chosen some good products, you've got a way of monetizing, you've got something to sell. And then the fourth one is building your profile, making sure people know who you are. And then the fifth one is doing joint ventures and partnerships and putting great strategic partners around you. And the reason I chose those is having worked with dragons from Dragon's Den, you know, in particular James Caan, who had a book out, having worked with Roger and John DeMartini and all these different people, all of the guys that we were sticking on stages, awesome at pitching on the stage, awesome books, blogs, articles, reports, awesome products, great profile, and they bring partnerships to the table and they do everything through joint ventures and partnerships. So I could just see them doing it. And I just saw, it's like, well, this isn't a mystery to me. I know how they do it. I know what I've been up close with these guys for years. I know what their behind the scenes looks like. And unless you've got that going on behind the scenes, you can't be that person. It's just not going to work for you. And I also saw all the money goes to key people of influence. So these guys, when you travel on the train with them from, you know, we'd do a speaking tour in Manchester, Birmingham, London. We'd start up in Manchester and we'd, you know, do some talks, and then we'd catch the train and do some talks and catch the train. And you just basically people trying to get on the train so they can pitch you a deal, and people handing you business plans. Please have a look at my business plan. And like they create a mini eye of the storm around them, you know, like a dragon on the telly is going to – they are so spoiled for deals. Regardless of what deals they get on the Dragon's Den, they're getting hundreds of deals a week come to them. And that way, if they don't act on any of those deals for a month, they've got, call it 300 deals, 400 deals that they've seen or that have come buzzing around. You start to become very good at spotting what works or spotting a good deal. So I noticed that whereas most people in business are fighting to be seen, fighting to be heard, fighting to make things happen, these guys just curate stuff. It's just all coming to them all the time. So I knew the strategy. It's like, actually, if I just teach more people how to do that versus chasing.
And that's where it's a business model.
Yeah.
It's a leading question.
Yeah, it has. The Dent business has become a very successful business. We've eclipsed everything we've previously done. We're much more successful, much more stable, much more enjoyable, less stressful, more profitable business than we've ever been. I'm having more fun and we're a global business. We've got a portfolio of ventures that we've taken stakes in companies. We've bought companies, you know, so it's just been a really great, I mean, it's been an amazing 10 years.
Break the those 5 P's down, because it takes time to get them moving as well. Like I've done your program and we're kind of just seeing the benefits of all that now, like 2.5 maybe years after that.
And I think it keeps going. 6 months. You'll actually see, you do these 5 things, you'll see it just exponentially grow.
For me, looking at, especially people like we've had on this podcast, like Seb, like it really does work. It's not BS. This stuff actually works. I'm not getting any And there's no partnership here, by the way. But so like pitching.
Yeah.
Break pitching down, is there different styles?
Yeah, so there's three main pitches that you have to do well. And the first pitch is a social pitch. So just when someone says, tell me what do you do, you know, tell me a bit about yourself. You got to have a good answer for that, right? So you got to be able to have a good 20, 30 seconds that gets people to go, oh, actually, that's pretty good. But that's not an elevator. It's not... People think that that could lead to a $100,000 check, you know, here, quick, have some money, right? The best case scenario is it leads to a meeting and someone says, oh, we should meet, we should have a cup of coffee and talk about that. So that's a social pitch. And then a scheduled pitch is when you put something in the diary and you've got half an hour, an hour to talk, and you want to be able to be really well prepared for what you're going to say and how that conversation is going to go. And then the final one is a sales pitch, when you're actually selling something, selling a product, selling a deal, closing a sale. And you've got to be really well prepared for that as well. You've got to do the preparation. You know, people say, oh, just be yourself. Don't be yourself. Right? Because we don't naturally like to sell. Right? We don't naturally like to pitch. We like to just, you know, get along and just be quiet and just be nice and all this sort of stuff. You've got to prepare. You've got to prepare for every one of those pitching scenarios. I mean, it's the same. Your guys, you know, relate to a military situation. You can't just go on and be yourself. You got to do the training. You got to do what the training says to do. So it's the same with pitching. If you just rely upon how you would naturally handle a situation, it's not going to lead anywhere. You got to do the training as to how you're going to handle a pitching situation.
I've been I was chatting to an influential person within the military community recently about that. And about how, and he's pitching towards like charities in the charity sector, but he's like, you've got to kind of almost flick a switch and start acting. But acting, you've got, it's got to be you, but you've got to be you kind of with more purpose and meaning and more structure to it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I went out again and again and again. I went everywhere. People, you know, even if it wasn't relatable to my industry, I would go out and practice and pitch like these smaller pitches
To
build the confidence. Yeah. You can't just go, you're not going to expect to go into a meeting and, like you said, 30 seconds later, like, there's a big fat check.
Boom. And, you know, and people, I do get frustrated when people tell entrepreneurs, just go out and be yourself and, you know, just go meet that, you know, someone says, oh, I've got a meeting with this guy who's the CEO of this company and we could do a deal. It's like, how should I handle it? Oh, you'll be fine. It's like, well, wait a second. If you're an actor on a stage and, you know, imagine you go see Les Mis and they stand up on the stage and they just say, by the way, guys, I'm just not feeling it today. I just, you know, I'm just going to be myself. I'm just going to kind of, you know, I'm just going to do what I feel like doing. It's like, no, that's not what we paid for. Yeah. We paid for, we want to see you sing the song, right? So you've got to practice. You've got to rehearse. You've got to role play. This is the other thing. Huge amount of success in business and sales, especially, is role play. You know, behind the scenes with your buddy, you practice how a sales presentation is going to go, and you do, you know, before you go and do a live sales meeting, you might do 10 hours of role play, just so that you've got every objection handled. You know what you're going to say. You've thought it through. It's not that you're coming up with clever things to say, you know, verbal aikido. It's that you've thought through their position. You've thought through, you know, sometimes you might be role-playing and one of your sales guys that you're role-playing with says, oh, well, what about this? And you go, oh, God, I don't have a good answer for that. Don't know. So then you have to go and figure it out, right? And maybe that means adjusting the product, or it means adjusting the way you deliver it, or adjusting the payment plans or whatever it is. But sometimes you expose genuine flaws in the business when you do the role-play. So it sounds so weird for most people to hear that a successful entrepreneur should be doing a lot of role play. But I suppose for a military person listening, I mean, that's just what you do, right? You don't run onto a real battlefield. The first time you run onto a battlefield, you've probably done years of training, you know, in many cases. So you've done lots and lots of role play. You've done a lot of drills and role play and all this sort of stuff before you're in any form of live scenario.
It's a good, and then guys, especially in transition where you're going for a job interview, like it's still all pitching, Yeah. Don't go as yourself.
No, like, no, be ready.
Get ready.
Be ready. And do the role play. Mm. It sounds so silly, but sit down with a friend and say, you be the hiring guy and interview me, and let's do a role play. And I mean, you know, and maybe if you know of a friend who's going to go for a job interview, be the guy who reaches out to them and says, do you want to role play it? Do you want to just sit down and we'll pretend to do a job interview scenario, and we'll role play it through a few times. Let's block out a couple of hours and just practice.
Mm.
And if you can do that for a friend, that could be the very difference between them getting the job or not.
Mm. Well, the other four P's, Daniel's book's called The Key Pairs of Influence. I'd absolutely recommend getting it. Going on to assets and being deficient in assets, I suppose, initially with business, and then building assets, because funnily enough, your next book is 24 Assets.
Yeah.
Available in all good bookshops.
And even the bad ones.
Yeah. why is it so important? And what is, you know, if an asset is something useful and valuable?
An asset is something that holds onto its value regardless of where the business owner is in the world. So if I've got a website and that's sitting online, generating leads, helping my business to function and run, then I would call that a digital asset. If I've got a podcast that sits on the iTunes podcast store, it doesn't, like this podcast, right? It doesn't matter where you and I go from here. We record something, it sits on the podcast radio store or the store, and then someone can download that in the future and they listen to it and they go, oh, okay, I heard about that. That's really good. That's an asset. So you're creating an asset. I've got videos that sit on YouTube that get 1,000 plays per month, and that just keeps bringing in people who say, oh, I watched that video on YouTube, and then I, you know, read your book, and now I want to do business. So that's an asset. My books are an asset, right? Doesn't matter where I go in the world. If I go on a holiday, Amazon is still selling my books. So eventually, you end up with lots of assets, and your goal in business is to build lots and lots of assets. So where you start is you start with hustle, and you start with picking up the phone, talking to strangers, practicing your pitch, role-playing, you know, getting out there and trying to make those first few sales. So you go into hustle mode, and then you go into income mode, where you're trying to make money and just trying to, you know, solve problems for people and put together a little bit of a team and all that sort of stuff. And that will cause more stress and more, it's a lot of time that you spend doing that, and you really, you know, you're working hard for that. Where it turns a corner, so where people have got it good, is they've got two extra things, influence and assets. So influence is where you become that key person of influence, like we talked about. But even still, that can cause you even more stress. So if you become famous, but you don't have a lot of assets around you, it's all you, it's all your time for money.
Mm.
You know, people want you to go and speak. They want you to be at the conference. They want you to jump on the plane. They want you to sell, make the sale. They want you to be there on the spot doing the thing. Right, that can be very stressful in its own right. And the next step behind that is that you end up with assets. And when you have assets, you're in a different category of life. So you end up, the assets do the work. So a traditional example of someone who's got assets, imagine someone who's been in the military 20, 30 years, and every couple of years they bought themselves a little rental property, and they've got a tenant, and then they end up with 10 properties that have mostly paid for themselves, and they've got the assets in the background. On the day that they stop working, they say, well, it doesn't matter really. My work is only one way that I earn money. I've got 10 houses that all pay income. So they're actually earning more asset income than time for money income. So it's the same in business. You start off work, 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 but where you get to the point where business is enjoyable is when you get to this point where you've got assets in the business. And the assets are your systems, your intellectual property, it's your media and your content, it's your products, it's your culture that keeps attracting good people to the culture. It's all of those kind of things that it can sometimes be things like a prestigious award, that if you've won a prestigious award, that keeps helping you to win business for years.
Mm.
So that becomes a bit of an asset. We call that a market asset. So the more assets that you build, the business just naturally grows, and it's naturally profitable. It has a life of its own. It takes on, you know, an energy of its own, regardless of what you're doing. The only difference is that if you think of a house as one thing, a house is not one thing. It's a roof, it's a walls, it's kitchen, it's bathroom, it's electricity, it's plumbing. It's actually lots of things that all work together.
Location, access,
yeah,
all those things.
All of that. And it's all working together. And then it looks like one thing because we're so used to seeing them. But a business is the same. It's not one thing. It's IP, systems, products, culture, funding, market positioning, brand, right? So it's all of these things that sit together, and there's 24 of them. And basically, when it all comes together, it's like a house all coming together. It becomes one thing. So when you get a business that has all 24 assets, then it's almost got a life of its own. It's its own thing.
Can you start building assets with no money?
You don't want to do it too soon, because it's almost like trying to get a car started in gear 3 or 4. It's very hard. You stall the engine. So when I see people who try and start a business, especially if they don't have a lot of money, and they try and start a business by investing into brand or systems or culture or, you know, really great product development or innovation, everything's taking too long to get off the ground, and they never get off the ground. So unfortunately, you have to go about things the hard way, which means you have to start with just hustle and sales and holding things together with sealing wax and string.
Well, go on then. Let's take it there. So I'm going to give you a scenario.
Yeah.
You've got 3 months' wages and rent, right? So you're cool for 3 months.
I'm good for 3 months.
And you've got 10K in the bank.
Yeah.
Let's start with a business. If we're not going for mental with assets,
yeah,
where do we start? Where would Daniel Priestley start?
Well, I actually did this. So this is very similar. So when I came to London in 2006, I had a suitcase and a credit card. And I had money in Australia, but the exchange rate was 3 to 1, or the almost 3 to 1. I didn't want to spend the money. So I think at the time, $70,000 translated into about £22,000 or something like that. So I set myself this challenge called the suitcase and credit card challenge, which is I had the credit card balances, and I basically said, I'm going to arrive in London with a suitcase and a couple of credit cards, and if I can't get something off the ground with these credit cards, then I'll have the money in Australia to clear the credit cards, but I'll put my tail between my legs and I'll go home. So I did start with nothing. I'd never been above the equator. I didn't know anybody. And I basically had to go from my big 5-bedroom house in Australia with a swimming pool and a little waterfall and all that sort of stuff to a shitty little 1-bedroom, a room rented in a Putney flat, 3 of us living in a 2-bedroom flat. And I remember very, very hot summer in 2006, I bought one of those phone fax printers and I sat it on my bed, and at nighttime I'd sleep in my bed, and in the daytime I'd hit the phones and I'd have my laptop, my phone, and I almost, you know, for the first couple of weeks, I was sitting in this stupid hot little bedroom making phone calls and doing stuff pretty much night and day in the bedroom, other than going out and meeting people for meetings and setting up bank accounts and all this sort of stuff that I was doing. But what did I do? My first move in London was to host a dinner. And I hosted a dinner. I put together a dinner of 26 of the most influential people I could get in a room. So I hired a private dining room. It was £1,650 from memory. I think it was £28 a head. And it was half a bottle of white or red wine and 2-course meal or something like that. And it was this nice little Italian restaurant near Charing Cross. No, near Chancery Lane. So I literally got in touch with as many people as I could. I said, I'm launching a business. I don't know anyone in London. I don't know anyone in the UK. I would love to invite you out to dinner. I've selected a list of the most influential people I can find. You're on the list. And I said, and good news, I've invited this person, and this person who you've heard of. And they went, oh, okay, are they going? And we go, well, yeah, they're going to be there. Oh, okay, well, if they're going, I'll be there too. And then I'd call someone else and say, well, this person's just agreed they're coming. Oh, okay, well, if they're going, then I'll go as well. So I basically hustled together a room of 26 people. And on the night, I, you know, let everyone have dinner and a few drinks and glasses of wine. And then I stood up at the end and I said, I'm launching a business. I've got my diary here. I'd love to have a one-to-one meeting with you to discuss how we could work together on the launch of the business. I'm going to launch with a big event. We're going to get 300 or 400 people together. I'd really love for you to use your networks to be part of it, and I'd love to pay you the money that we would normally pay towards newspaper advertising or commissions or salespeople. I'd love that to go back to this room. So we've sectioned across 25% of every sale to go back to this influencer community here. And if you'd be open to having a meeting with me, I can explain how we intend to launch and what we're going to be doing. And if you want to get involved, you can get involved. So I think I booked, I do remember it was 28 people, and I booked 26 into my diary for the following for the following 10 days. So I had back to back meetings with everyone, and at the end of it, I got them all to agree that they would be part of my launch event. And sure enough, we got 400-500 people into a room, into a big launch event. And from memory, we might have made £150,000 worth of sales straight off. So $3,000 product, probably 50 sales. So it was about £150,000 worth of sales out of 400 people.
So, and what was the product?
So we were launching with Roger Hamilton. We had what was called the Wealth Dynamics Workshop package. It was basically a training program plus profiling, working with your team. It was basically a training and development program that was, you know, sort of 2 months, 60-day challenge as well. So it was all packaged up for $3,000. We basically launched. We had a big Roger Hamilton event to kick off with. So
you partnered with someone who had a product, and then you end up getting the market.
Yeah, so Roger had the product. So yeah. Wealth Dynamics and Roger was the product. And then I went out to the 27 or 28 people, 26 of them said yes. I went out to those guys to do the marketing, to put together the event. So they had the market. Roger had the product. And basically we pulled together an event of 400 people down in Tottenham Court Road. And Roger had a proven track record of being able to sell from stage and being able to...
Well, he's a good-looking man.
He's a good-looking man. He was then.
Tall, dark, and
12 years ago, right?
So and he's good-looking now.
He's a good guy, great talker, experienced product, so lots of case studies and stories and examples, lots of big, well-known entrepreneurs were endorsing. He had his book ready, so we did a book launch. We did everyone got a copy of the book. Everyone bought a ticket to the event. We gave a bunch of commissions back to the affiliates, and then we were away. So we then repeated that four times that year. So, and each time got bigger and bigger. I think we launched in Manchester, Birmingham, London. I think roughly speaking, it was about $250,000 in sales each time. So we did like £1 million worth of sales for Roger in year one. I think we took it up to maybe two or three million in the following year.
Were you doing the same format? So was you reaching out to people in each city? How was you doing it?
So we went and found initially, this was prior to Facebook ads.
Mm.
Now you can just kind of bypass this and just go straight through Facebook and throw the money into Facebook ads. But because we didn't have a budget, we also had to just go with affiliates. And we gave big healthy commission checks to the affiliates. But that's what got us launched, and there was no cost, no money up front. It was basically we didn't have to pay until after a sale was made. So the beauty of that model was that once someone spent the $2,000 or $3,000 with us, then the £600 that we owed to the affiliate got paid, 30 days after the money was collected. So we were,
easy as that.
Yeah.
And yeah, you just like, I was expecting you to say, so like, you got to really work hard and all that. It's like, well, you do, but you've got to use what you've got. And actually creating or going to, what would you say that was then? Going to the market, bringing the market to you?
It was basically working with the people who already had influence. They already were key people of influence. The philosophy is that the assets are already out there. The everything you already need is already out there. You don't have to invent it. You just got to connect the dots. So it's just a strategy of connecting the dots.
Yeah.
I position myself as an influencer by picking a nice restaurant and getting everyone around me. And everyone suddenly was talking. I had all these. I actually had 28 pretty influential people come along. Head of BNI and the head of Academy and the head of IOD, one of the top people there. And so I had all these really interesting people. And when I stood up, I said, I've only been in the country for 3 weeks, but already I've identified who are the top influencers. And, over here we've got the head of the IOD, and over here we've got the head of...
So people who had access to a lot of businesses.
They had access to my market, yeah.
Yeah.
And basically everyone looked at me and went, wow, this guy's 26 years old, and he's pulled together the 28 top people in the industry for a night for dinner.
Mm. What was you wearing, shirt or T-shirt?
I would have been wearing a suit back then. Oh. I would have worn suit and tie, suited and booted back in the day.
How would you structure a business, even like maybe 0 to 12 people?
Well, look, here's the other thing. You asked me this question. Keep in mind, the one thing to keep in mind, I'd built a $10 million business prior to that. Mm. I'd built a national business in Australia doing $10 million plus worth of sales at a multi-million dollar partnership under my belt prior to doing that. So even though I was young, even though I was 26, I did have a bit of experience. And I'd also done 2 years working for John prior to that. Mm. So the one thing I would say is, even though that story sounds impressive, it's probably worth not taking it out of context. And the context is that I was first a number two before I was a number one. I was a grunt for John. And then I worked my way into being his lance corporal, and then I went off and started my own section, my first little fire team, and then a section, and all of that sort of stuff. But if you think about it in those terms, if you're first leaving the military and you're thinking about being an entrepreneur, it's probably not a bad idea. See, people have it. Sorry, I'm going off on tangents, but people have it in their mind that you're either working for a massive organization or you're starting your own business as the entrepreneur. And so it's like, oh, I'm either in the military or I'm starting my own business, or I'm working in the NHS or I'm starting my own business, or I'm working for, you know, BMW or I'm starting my own business, or, you know, Vodafone. It's like there's actually 5.7 million businesses, little businesses that already exist. So you don't have to start your own business. There's 5.7 million of them that you could go and join, and a lot of them are less than 10 people. So I really strongly recommend that if you've never started a business, do 6 months to 2 years working in someone else's small business, sweeping the floor if necessary. Like, just go and, like, let's say you say, oh, you know, maybe I should start a hair salon. Fine, go and sweep the floor for 6 months in someone else's hair salon and learn what's going on, right? Maybe I should be a business coach. Go and work as a business coach's appointment setter. Go and be an executive assistant to a business coach. You know, go find the top leadership coach who's ex-military, who's making a success of it, and go and say, I will work for you for nothing for 3 months if necessary. Working for someone for nothing or next to nothing, or for any, you know, if you said to someone, name your price, it's not about the money, I really just want to work with you and I want to learn, but I also want to serve. In your first 3 months of business, you're going to go backwards anyway. So earning nothing is actually better than going backwards. So you might as well just do a couple of months of, you know, you might as well do a couple of months working for someone who's making it work. With no stress. At least, or, you know, do a deal and just say, put me on minimum wage. Just put me on £10 an hour or something like that. Let me come in and help. Let me come in and do 3 months with you, 3 to 6 months. Just let me serve. Let me help you with whatever I can. Let me pick up the phones, you know, let me call back lists of people, you know, whatever needs doing. You give me whatever jobs you think would actually add some value. But just being around a small business of 4, 6, 7, 8 people and just being in the office or being around the team and seeing what's there and seeing what's functioning, that's a better step than just starting your own business on day one.
There we go. Lastly, I want to finish up on something that I know is close to you, your heart, close to your business heart as well. That's the UN Global Goals, that's community, that's kind of everyone contributing to creating something better for everyone else. Like, we started right at the beginning saying about news, like, don't worry about the news, don't worry about the media, where it's kind of gone the opposite now, and let's look at how small business especially can impact around the world in a positive way. It's something that we started the business to achieve, but I know you do as well.
Yeah, so a big part of what we do now is United Nations Global Goals. So the mission of Dent is for businesses to stand out, scale up, and make a dent in the universe, make a positive impact. And the way we do that is by starting with the United Nations Global Goals. Whether you know, whatever your thoughts are of the whole organization of the UN, the UN Global Goals are a phenomenal base plate of information about the problems in the world that need solving. and it's a great framework for looking at what needs to happen to improve the planet. Rather than watching the news, which makes you feel a bit powerless to do anything, the United Nations Global Goals actually say this is where you could help, this is something you could do, and it's very empowering. So you might say, actually, I really feel strongly about clean water in every community around the world, and I want to do something for clean water. Great. Talk to Charity Water. Look at Scott Harrison's book, Thirst. Start a buy one, give one campaign with buy one, give one. And, you know, every time you make a sale, package in a clean water package. So there are so many ways that you can use business as a force for good. And for really selfish reasons, if you wanted to be just be selfish about it, well, I know that your business would do better if it had giving built into it. I know that you'd engage more customers. You'd have more to talk about with your suppliers. You would have more reasons for someone to join your company as an employee because you're a business with a force for good. So, you know, it also gets you, one thing I love about the United Nations Global Goals is it's very hard to be obsessed with your own problems when you get excited about the world's problems. Like when you actually start getting excited about what you could do for a really important cause, then you stop stressing about, you know, it takes you out of yourself, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's very easy to kind of get bogged down or weighed down with your own challenges and problems. And sometimes one of the best things that kind of makes you feel uplifted is the idea of getting on with working on something important and meaningful. And when you put that at the heart of the business, then the whole business kind of comes alive around that purpose.
Mate, you've supported me more than you'll know. You provide value, reality, guidance, and I know this conversation will impact many more. Thank you very much, and we will leave it there.
What a pleasure.